and the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please call the roll.
Mr. Scala?
Here.
Mr. Thomas?
Here.
Ms. Nauzer?
Here.
Ms. Peters?
Here.
Mr. McDavid?
Here.
Mr. Ruffin?
Here.
Mr. Trapp?
Here.
We have minutes from the regular council meeting of February 1st, 2016. Other corrections? If not, may I have a motion and a second for approval?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Are there any changes to the agenda?
I do. Could we pull off B-22-16?
And where will that go? Will that go under...
Old business.
B-22-16 goes to old business.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Mayor, I'd like to pull off R-18-16.
And I believe that goes to new business?
Correct.
New business.
Are there any other changes to the agenda? If not, may I have a motion to approve the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Welcome to the meeting. There are several opportunities for public comment during city council meetings. After each public hearing, after each old business, each new business item, and at the end of the meeting, there is an open comment section where each individual can speak for 3 minutes about anything. Each individual is limited to 3 minutes, there is a clock in front of the dais here, and I'll ask you to respect the time. If you are a representative of a group that's primarily involved in the issue, you may ask for and will receive 5 minutes. I'll ask Jim Baker, Rick Baker, Kathy Baker, Ramona Mack, Brian Higginbotham, Dayton Grubber, Muhammad Johnson, Janelle Tweehouse, Erica Kaufman, and Fire Chief Randy White to join me at the podium. The life-saving award is presented to citizens who either helped city firefighters in a life-saving effort or who were involved in life-saving at an emergency scene before the fire crews could arrive. On January 11, 2016, James Baker had a cardiac arrest while exercising at our activity and recreation center. Mr. Baker's wife, Kathy, along with citizen Ramona Mack and ARC employees Dayton Grubber, Muhammad Johnson, Janelle Tweehouse, Brian Higginbotham, and Erica Kaufman, performed CPR, and that has obviously resulted in saving Mr. Baker's life. Chief Witt. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much. I'll invite Jan Neitzert, the Executive Director of the Missouri Park and Recreation Association, Mike Mathis, and Mike Griggs to join me at the podium.
My name is Jan Neitzert. I'm the Executive Director of the Missouri Park and Recreation Association. We are a 501c3 incorporated in 1959. Our mission is to advocate for the quality of life through effective use of parks and recreation opportunities, education, and resources. The premier event of our education calendar is our annual conference, which is scheduled for next week, February 23rd through the 26th, here in Columbia, for the first time in 10 years. We'll be bringing about 400 people to town. They'll be taking tours, spending the week, of course, enjoying some socialization, 75-plus education sessions. And we're being hosted graciously by the City of Columbia's department and the Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism at Mizzou. I'd like to take a moment, especially in light of what just transpired here, to mention that along with giving awards to a lot of different people at our annual conference, one of them is the Public Official Award. And we give that to someone who's an elected official or a leader, a volunteer leader, who has shown their understanding of and support for parks and recreation. And some of you might say, I'm not sure why you need support. Nobody doesn't like parks and recreation. Unfortunately, when things are tight, and it seems like they always are, sometimes parks and recreation is seen as kind of the fluff. One of those nice-to-haves, but maybe not a must-have. And while I am biased, especially in light of what we just were able to witness, I hope everyone sees that it is much beyond a nice-to-have. I dare say that Mr. Baker would call this essential services within the City of Columbia. Columbia has always kind of set the gold standard in the state, but it's bigger than that, and this is an opportunity to inform you. Some of you may be friends of the park here in Columbia, but to inform everyone in America of the value of what parks and recreation brings to the quality of life. For the million Americans employed in parks and recreation, for businesses who know that quality parks and recreation is the number two reason that people choose to locate to a community, for communities who benefit from $140 billion in economic activity every year, for citizens who care about clean air and water, which is what they care about the most, for children whose only chance for a healthy meal when school is out is through summer meal programs through Parks and Recreation, for seniors who live longer and healthier when they have the chance to be active and be social, for teens who are less likely to smoke, drink, do drugs, and vandalize when organized positive options are available to them, for men, women, and children who have affordable opportunities to get healthy and stay healthy, which, by the way, saves everyone money, for citizens who have access to trails, parks, recreation programs, and open space, regardless of age, income, physical, or mental ability. That sounds pretty essential to me. Despite this overwhelming evidence, and there is evidence for each one of these areas, some leaders don't get it. Budgets get tight and the parks are closed, programs are discontinued, and employees are laid off. But thankfully not in my hometown and not in yours. Somewhere around 95 million results is what you get if you Google the benefits of parks and recreation. 95 million. If you do that at home tonight, you will find that number one or number two, depending on the day, says the City of Columbia, Missouri. And how awesome is that? The recipient of our 2016 Public Official Achievement Award this year is unable to attend our award ceremony next week at conference. So we have brought it to him today. Please congratulate Mayor Bob McDavid, our Public Official Achievement Award winner for 2016.
I accept this award because of my peers on the council and for previous city councils in the past who have made our park system what it is today.
Bob McDavid has actively supported Columbia Parks and Recreation in the 6 years he has served as Columbia's mayor. Only a few months after being elected mayor in 2010, he campaigned for the renewal of the park sales tax, speaking to numerous community groups in support of the tax extension. Having served on the Board of Trustees for the Boone Hospital, he was well known in the business community for being fiscally responsible. Hence his article published in the Columbia Business entitled, Proposition 1, Park Sales Tax Strengthens Local Economy, was a great help in influencing the business community to support the tax extension. During his tenure, Mayor McDavid was a constant feature at Columbia Park dedications. When he addressed the crowd, he often made public expressions extolling the Columbia Parks and Recreation as one of the finest departments in city government. His sincere public compliments to Parks and Recreation staff validated their hard work and promoted a positive image of Parks and Recreation to the community. Mayor McDavid is an avid trail user and has voted in favor of the trail projects even amidst vocal public opposition, largely from affected neighbors. The following was recorded in the official City Council minutes regarding McDavid. He believed Columbia was special, and one of the reasons it was special was due to the parks and trail system, as it was a great asset. He stated he would support this trail project. In 2015, Mayor McDavid proclaimed July as Parks and Recreation Month in the city of Columbia. When the park sales tax came up for renewal in November of 2015, he again assisted with speaking engagements. As he prepares to retire as mayor of Columbia in April 2016, we congratulate the City of Columbia's mayor, Bob McDavid, winner of the 2016 MPRA Public Official Award.
We'll move to appointments to boards and commissions. The Integrated Water Resource Planning Committee has one qualified applicant for the two vacancies. May I have a motion and a second to appoint Robert Roper?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. For the Public Transit Advisory Commission, we have three qualified applicants for the three general vacancies. May I have a motion of second to appoint Catherine Lee?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. May I have a motion of second to appoint Alice Turner?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. May I have a motion of second to appoint Don Zetterberg?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. For the Commission on Human Rights, we have four qualified applicants for the two vacancies. Please call the roll for the first vacancy.
Mr. Scala.
Dean Gabriel.
Mr. Thomas. Oh,
should be Gabriel Dean, shouldn't it? Should be the other way around. Sorry about that.
Mr. Thomas.
I'll call him Scott Dean, but Gabriel Dean.
Ms. Nauzer.
Gabriel Dean.
Ms. Peters.
Gabriel Dean.
Mr. McDavid.
Gabriel Dean.
Mr. Ruffin.
Gabriel Dean.
Mr. Trapp.
I'm going to call him Scott Dean as well.
Please call the roll on the second vacancy.
Mr. Scala.
Zach Rubin.
Mr. Thomas.
Zach Rubin.
Ms. Nauzer.
Zach Rubin.
Ms. Peters.
Mark Hall Smith.
Mr. McDavid.
Peggy Wood.
Mr. Ruffin.
Zach Rubin.
Mr. Trapp.
Zach Rubin.
Zach Rubin has it. For the Substance Abuse Advisory Commission, we have two qualified applicants for the one general vacancy. Please call the roll.
Mr. Scala.
Gary Smith.
Mr. Thomas.
Gary Smith.
Ms. Nauzer.
Gary Smith.
Ms. Peters.
Gary Smith.
Mr. McDavid.
Gary Smith.
Mr. Ruffin.
Gary Smith.
Mr. Trapp.
Gary Smith.
Those who have contacted the city manager's office by noon on Wednesday prior to the council meeting can speak at the beginning of the meeting on a topic, any topic that's not on the agenda. Only two people can speak on the same topic. We have one request tonight. I will point out that the council does not address issues brought up under scheduled public comment at the time the comments are made, but that the council very likely may discuss this at the end of the meeting. I'll yield 5 minutes to Lynn Maloney.
Poor communication, lack of transparency, and lack of trust between frontline officers and supervisors were the topics of a 2006 report on the organizational analysis of the Columbia Police Department. These were the same topics highlighted in the 2012 Anderson report, also on the police department. And again, the December 2015 report written by six CPD officers in response to the six pillars of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing cites these two early reports as still valid descriptions of the department today. You did not receive this 130-page report from CPD until New Year's Eve when it reappeared on the pre-council agenda for January 4th, hardly giving you enough time to read the lengthy report on the detail. Nerds like me, however, did read the report, and so some of you may have joined me spending your holiday weekend in that way. The lack of congruence between what the six officers wrote in the report and what was reported in their oral presentation to you is significant. Could this be a reflection of a continued lack of transparency and poor communication? At that pre-council meeting, Councilman Thomas asked whether the CPD could make its policies and procedures public. CPD responded that it does not own its policies and procedures as they were provided by a vendor whose agreement precludes sharing the document publicly. In other words, CPD did not write their own policies and procedures. The Columbia police officer who wrote about Pillar 1 had this to say about the value of policies for the police department. This is from page 12. While CPD does have training and policy which suggest a guardian mindset, the question remains if the frontline officers and supervisors actually practice what is in policy and training. If policy or training conflicts with department culture, behaviors will not change. The officer goes on to refer to the 2012 Anderson report and the 2006 report. These reports document the culture of CPD as lacking the trust, communication, and department unity required to embrace procedural justice. This officer is encouraged that training and procedures that support procedural justice are in place, yet also recognizes that more must be done to win the trust of the community and suggests that the department acknowledge past and present injustices and suggests that the department describe what they have done to correct these injustices. See page 14. The officer who authored the department's response to Pillar 2 refers extensively to the department's policy and procedures manual to demonstrate compliance with the task force recommendation. These are the policies and procedures that are not available to the public because they are not owned by CPD. The President's task force report calls for, quote, comprehensive policies on the use of force and stipulates these policies be clear, concise, and openly available for public inspection. See page 52. The officer who discusses the second pillar notes, this is a substantial paradigm shift for all American law enforcement. The recommendations of the President's task force are indeed paradigm shifts, as the CPD officer noted. Citing the department's policies when those policies were not authored by CPD is hardly a persuasive demonstration that the department is anywhere close to fulfilling the recommendations of the task force report. So what are we to do? The officer who researched Pillar 1 does make two suggestions. First, reviewing the 2012 Anderson report for ideas on how to begin that cultural shift. This report is available on the city's website for you to peruse if you've not done so already. Secondly, she also suggests that explicit acknowledgement of past wrongs, coupled with ongoing public conversation about the ways the department intends to make amends, would be an excellent step in the right direction for building trust within the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maloney. We'll move to public hearings. Please read P PH 6-16.
PH 616 is determining if the Regency Hotel Tax Increment Financing Redevelopment Plan and Project is making satisfactory progress under the proposed time schedule contained within the approved plans for completion of such project.
Staff, please.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. Some of you were on the Council back in February of 2011 will remember that we approved the TIF financing redevelopment plan for the former Regency Hotel project, now known as the Broadway. Just as a quick reminder, that was about a $20.3 million project, of which the city elected to provide $3.2 million of funds to assist with that particular development. The purposes of this public hearing tonight is basically a statutory one. We're required by the TIF Act to hold a public hearing 5 years from the point that which the redevelopment plan was approved, and the redevelopment plan was approved back in February of 2011, even though the actual Broadway did not open for business until early, mid, I think, 2014. The actual TIF clock, which is a 23-year time period during which the developer can receive back those funds that have been allocated, in this case $3.2 million, the TIF clock starts at the time that the redevelopment plan was approved, which was in February of 2011. So the purpose of this public hearing is basically just simply to show that the Regency Hotel TIF redevelopment plan and project is making satisfactory progress. I think we provided you with a copy of this originally, and it should be in your packet, but I do have, just in case it's hard to read, and it may be very hard to read on here, I'll pass out some of these copies. It may be a little bit easier to read. This was prepared in based upon the funds that were actually generated as of November of 2014, because obviously there is a delay in tax reporting, so the numbers that you will see on this spreadsheet reflect all activity through November of 2014. With this particular TIF project, 50% of the EATs that were collected, you'll see a line in there that says total EATs generated. EATs are the economic activity taxes, which are the sales taxes that are generated as a result of selling materials, for example, at the restaurant, things of that nature. And the pilot taxes are the property taxes, the real estate taxes that are generated as a result of that property. So you can see for the years 2013 through November of 2015, the total EATs generated on that particular project were $71,546. There are three taxing jurisdictions who have basically agreed to utilize their funds, their sales tax funds, for this TIF process. And so for the City of Columbia, that was $36,720. Boone County was $25,348, and the CID was $9,477. The payment in lieu of tax, the pilot, this is the Regency, is for the Regency, is the real estate taxes. And for tax year 2014, that particular project generated pilot or real estate taxes in the amount of $76,836.12. Even though, as I said, this was through 2014, I can tell you that the pilot generated through, or for the calendar year 2015, was $157,978. So if you look at the grand total of EATs and pilots, you can take that figure we've given you as a total of $148,382 and add to it the pilot that was collected for calendar year 2015 of $157,000. So it's closer to a little over $300,000 that's been generated and been used to basically pay off the bonds, or the, not the bonds, the notes, the TIF notes that we issued, that were issued against this project. So I'm pleased to report that at this point in time, the Regency Hotel TIF redevelopment plan is making sufficient project. We expect the notes to be paid off probably before the 23-year period is up, but based upon their current performance, they're certainly well on that track.
Any questions from Council? I'll open the public hearing. Would anyone like to speak? Seeing none, we'll move to discussion. I think I've been on council for 6 years. We've done one TIF. This is it. And unfortunate that we face a lawsuit by the county commission, because I think this city council has been very judicious and very cautious in its use of tax increment financing. It used it only one time. The Tiger was the year before, I believe, right?
Yes.
But it was successful. Those of us that remember the Regency Hotel prior to its demolition understand how much Columbia has been helped by this process. So I hope that the next council, the next county commissioners can put an end to this dispute over TIF, because I believe it's been used very fairly and very appropriately by the city of Columbia.
Just a comment to build on that. I mean, I absolutely concur. I hope the city and the county can come to some sort of a reasonable agreement between some of our differences. A lot of it had to do with TIF. I mean, I was around early enough to have established the first TIF commission, and one of the first TIFs that came through was the Tiger Hotel. And certainly I always maintained at that time, and several of us did on the city council, the TIFs were a useful tool if we evaluated them on a case-by-case basis. There were some other issues, and lots of politics got in the way between our two governing institutions, if you will. I regret the hard feelings. I wish we could work things out a little bit better. But this, apparently, this is part of what that argument was all about. That is, reporting requirements for the existing TIFs. And I'm not going to go into that. I mean, we don't need any more comment about that. It's come down, and we will or we will not pursue this. But at any rate, I do hope that we can mend some fences to the extent that we can and move forward, because it is a useful tool. I still believe, however, it ought to be used on a case-by-case basis.
No action is required. We'll move to PH 716 and B 2316. Please read the bills.
PH 716 is the construction of the Douglas Park Phase 2 Improvement Project to include construction of shelters, replacement of playground equipment, construction of a skate spot, ADA walkway improvements, the installation of new signage, and park lighting improvements. Council Bill 2316 is an ordinance determining it is in the public interest to construct the Douglas Park Phase 2 Improvement Project to include construction of shelters, replacement of playground equipment, construction of a skate spot, ADA walkway improvements, installation of new signage and park lighting improvements, approving and adopting plans and specifications, determining that a portion of the work shall be done by contract, calling for bids through the purchasing division, determining that a portion of the project shall be done by city employees, providing for payment for the improvement, authorizing the city manager to obtain, execute, and record all documents necessary for the improvement, providing for compliance with the prevailing wage law and state-mandated construction safety training, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. I'd like to introduce Gabe Huffington, our Park Services Manager. He's joining me here tonight in case you have any questions that I don't know the answers to. This is the second phase of improvements to Douglas Park. It's a $225,000 project that was identified and funded by the 2015 park sales tax. As you know, the council looked and did a master plan back in 2013 for Douglas Park, and this is really the second phase of that planning effort. Douglas Park's a little under seven-acre park located right on Providence Road there. It's in Ward 1. It's in part of our central area of the strategic plan. Douglas High School is right next to the park, and Jeff Middle School is just a little bit within it. Our proposed improvements include a new medium shelter, a new playground, a new small shelter, a smaller skate park or skate spot, as well as amenities such as new lighting, walkways, bike racks, horseshoe courts, batting cages. We're going to take down the old shelter and build a new one. We're going to relocate the new shelter a little closer to the baseball fields, right off of a new walkway that will be built through the park. Once the new shelter is built, we'll tear down the old one. We're going to redo the playground and add a small shelter by the playground so that parents can have a place to sit while they watch their kids play in the playground. The skate spot will be located down here in the area where we acquired some of the houses that were up for sale, that they approached us to buy them. And so that's a great way to expand into the park. We will contract that out with a skate park professional firm to help with the design of that. They'll work with local skateboard kids and kind of come up with it. That was one of the number one requests from those that go to Douglas High School, was to have a spot to skateboard. We actually went out, watched, and saw them all on the basketball court. So we think this will be a really desired amenity. As I mentioned earlier, we have other supporting amenities such as signs and all the same thing. The LED lights will be similar to what we have at Stevens Lake Park. We had an IP meeting at Douglas High School on the 13th. We had it posted at the Armory for a week, as well as online events, survey. We also spoke to several people at the MLK Day, the Candlelight March on Monday, February 18th. The commission endorsed it at their meeting on January 21st. So, council, following the public hearing, if you would approve the ordinance authorizing the project to proceed, we'd appreciate it. Vail, if you have any questions.
Yeah, I just have a question that I'm reminiscing a little bit because I can remember my son using the skate park in Cosmo when that was first developed. That was a long time ago, as I recall. I don't remember when that was exactly. Maybe you do. But there has been an outcry in lots of, it even came downtown for kids to use skateboards and so on and so forth, and that has been in demand for a long period of time. I was happy to see this amenity in addition to all of the others because I know there was some demand for it. But, this is another example, I think, of, and that's, the question is, do you remember when that was? That was a long time ago when that skate park was first established. They were even talking about getting sponsorships and competitions and all the rest of that stuff, and we never really got
it. It would have been in the early
90s. I'm thinking it was a long time ago.
So,
thank you.
Is the skate spot going to be dual use for BMX bikes?
Point. How big it is.
This one will not be, just due to the size. This is only about 4,500 square foot, and so for a BMX, you need a little bit more space than that.
Is there any plans to do a BMX bike? Because I thought we were going to build skate spots with the larger metal platforms that BMX folks could use too.
Well, certainly in some of the parks we could look at it, but this one we're space constricted. This will probably be one of our smaller of the skate spots we do just because of the space. We're filling up all the room we have. Now, if a guy went out there, we would build it beefy enough that it could handle it, but you don't want to mix them. That's the safety issue. Yeah. If I'm on a bike, and there's a 10-year-old out there and I lose control and hit him, it's going to be a damage, So we want to make sure that it's kind of like what happens at the skate park in Cosmo. There, as long as there's no one out there, the rangers will kind of look at them and talk to the bikers and say, hey, we're working on a spot for you, but right now you can't be out here. But until someone comes and skate, we work with them on it. So, and I think that would be the case here.
Okay.
Would anyone from the public like to speak?
Oh, sorry, Bob, I did have a couple of questions. You mentioned the IP meeting at Douglas High School and survey and posting at the Armory. Did you get positive responses to the plan from that?
Well, on the 13th meeting we didn't. It was one of those really cold nights. Oh, okay. It was really bad. we didn't get all. We talked to a bunch of basketball kids that were going into the gym. They came by and they were all for it. All that. But we didn't really get the community like we'd hoped for, which is why we added it some more. We did it, but really the whole entire plan really represented almost 2 years worth of planning. We had design charrettes up at the Armory where we had police officers and park staff and neighbors all working on tables, coming up with their own park plan. So we really did a lot of work up front. And I think a lot of this represents just they've already done the work.
Right. And so they didn't bother to come out and tell you again.
Right. And I don't remember like when we did the first phase, Mayor McDavid remembers this because he told the kids there was a bunch of skateboarders showed up wanting to get funded, and we told them, well, we didn't have the money. If you get out and support the park sales tax, we'd come back with a second phase, and here we are. So,
right. Second question. Some of the work will be done by contract labor. Is there any opportunity to hire contract labor from the neighborhood as part of this construction project?
I don't know about that on this one because we have, for example, one of the contract labor will be the concrete walkways, and the city has a bid. We're working with some, and Mr. Mathis can go into some of the details about what we're trying to get to that point, but we're not there yet. And I don't, if we can, we will. But it's the city already has existing contracts for concrete flat work. mm-hmm. that we're using, and we based our estimates on that. So we might be able to. Some of our work that we hire, part-time staff, mm-hmm. we're making a big effort to try to get people, you know, in the neighborhoods to come and help work, because we know that people that live in near where they play,
yeah.
they have a much greater sense of accomplishment and pride in what they do. And so we like that aspect.
Yeah, great.
Well, I'll take that opportunity. Thanks, Mike. part of the strategic plan really does have us looking closely at hiring local. And so that's kind of been the banner above our efforts. Jim Witz recently agreed to, through a contract, help us look at, you know, what are the barriers to that now. And, you know, we do have some. It's a little bit bureaucratic when you work for the city. We do everything through RFPs or bids that are pretty thick, pretty convoluted process for most small businesses. So we're looking at what can we do, you know, what can we stop doing that creates a barrier. And so that's absolutely going to be a focus over the next year. Right. So I hope to have a better answer than that next time you ask.
Well, I really appreciate the fact that you're looking at that. I think there's a lot of benefits if we can focus our public dollars expenditure in that way.
Any other questions?
I don't have a question. I just want to say I think it's a great plan that sends a very important message to the community that Douglas Park is important. To the city at large and also to the residents who live nearby. I have one question, and that's do you have an estimated timeline when the work will be done?
Yeah, we will start in the spring. We are in the process right now of actually bidding out a couple of the contract portions of it, but we'll look to probably end of the summer into fall. We have a couple of events that we have to plan around, and then so we should be completed sometime August to September.
That's great. Thank you.
If there are no more questions, I'll open to the public hearing.
My name's John Clark. I live at 403 North 9th Street in the First Ward, about 1,000 yards from Douglas Park. And so I want to congratulate me. I have major problems with most of the department's planning efforts. And I don't just mean public outreach, but Parks and Rec has developed a much better model for various things. And so I know 2.5 years ago, I was at these meetings along with a bunch of people at Douglas High School and at the Armory and so forth. And so I'm quite pleased that out of that came a report that we've been through phase one, now it's phase two. I believe there's a phase three and a four that come from that original report. I mention this specifically because while it didn't make this particular cut, one of the things that I'm pleased to see in Parks and Rec is that it realized some time ago it just couldn't run and do all the programs. This business about helping doing the planning, creating the vision, and then working with not-for-profits and other groups, quite often providing the land and then somebody else owning. This is a long-term effort to build, but there was no way they could do it all, and it took for a long time they insisted on doing it. They've almost completed that transition, and I think it's to their great credit. In particular, one of the phase three or four items that came up, and I remember it was in the report that came out, was in Douglas Park on the east side, eventually there will be room for a building year-round, multi-story, probably not owned by the city, but to house various programs and allow various kind of things to go on year-round with the park. I look forward to that in the next 5 to 7 years, and this is just a great start. The other thing, and I've already mentioned it to him, is many of you know that there are a group of citizens in Columbia who are graduates of Douglas High School, and that every 2 or 3 years they continue to come back to Columbia. Now they're getting older. I believe it's for the black and white ball, and I believe 2016 is the next round. So I've mentioned to Mike that, and there are various people who know how to get a hold of them to let them know about this, so when they arrive, they won't be surprised. In fact, they'll be in a celebratory mood for this kind of stuff. including them and letting them know as this goes along is really important for that continuity and to honor their history, their contribution, and the contribution to Douglas Park and the Central City. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Anyone else? We'll move to council comments. Okay. Mr. Scala?
Just a few comments. We do it all the time, and we're kind of effusive in our praise with the Parks Department, and I think it's commendable what you do, and the model, as Mr. Clark suggested, is a good one, I think. But it is also true, it's amazing what you can do with a revenue stream that allows you to the independence to do this kind of creative thinking for the benefit of the community. We don't always have that luxury when it comes to some other issues like roads and so on and so forth. And I just want to make sure that I endorse Mr. Thomas's comments and the city manager's comments with respect to contracting, local contracting, and even a step further, minority contractor, and breaking down some of these barriers to this kind of thing. I returned from, I've said this before, but it's probably worth saying again, returned from a conference in Orlando, Florida, where they had a very successful program with public facilities in the minority community to locate those facilities there and also to break up these contracting jobs in sizable enough bites such that these companies could handle this stuff. And the end product was remarkable, and it was also remarkable that they could bring these folks back to appreciate what it was that they had done and to their children in terms of what it was that they had done. That's the direction I would like to go in, and I will certainly endorse any efforts, including the city manager's laudable efforts, to focus on some of these underserved areas in town in order to make this happen. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Any other comments?
Mr. Scala hinted at it, but I'll be explicit to thank the voters for the park sales tax. We wouldn't be able to have that dedicated source of funds without the ongoing support of the public for our excellent Parks Department.
I'll jump on that and congratulate and the Parks and Rec because, they've earned the respect and confidence of the citizens. And this is something that they've earned over, a couple of decades now. And they make promises and they keep them. And that allows the city to go back to the voters and ask to continue that revenue stream. And they continue to show their satisfaction and their confidence by continuing to renew that revenue stream. So congratulations again.
And I'll just add one other specific on that. I think that, and John hinted at it, that you do authentic community engagement to help the community design the park or the trail or the program. And I think that's really important. And I think that plays into why our park sales taxes pass so well. People are really engaged.
Please call the roll on B2316.
Council Bill 2316, Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Please read B2116.
Council Bill 2116 is an ordinance approving the final plat of Sam Subdivision, a re-subdivision of parts of lots 92 and 93 of the original town of Columbia, a minor subdivision, accepting the dedication of rights of way and easements, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
This is an application by ES&S Engineering Surveys and Services on behalf of their client, which is Rise Property LLC. To consolidate two parcels of land, the common address of the front parcel is 121 South 10th, and this replat is taking a 31-foot by 71-foot piece of property that fronts on a public alley in between 9th and 10th, and it consolidates it with the 121 South 10th piece, which is improved with a building known as the James Apartments, also known as the James Condominiums. So it would create a single lot, and as has been reported, this applicant is planning to include, or I should say the owner, who the applicant represents, is planning to acquire and build a much larger project that includes this property, which is about 0.2 acres. So
The reason for the platting is the 21 by 71 foot area did not qualify as a legal lot, so we informed the property owner that, or the contract purchaser, I should say, that we would not issue a building permit unless it was platted through the city's process. All the other parcels on this block that's between 9th and 10th, Locust and the alley, do qualify as legal lots. They're some combination of the three original Town of Columbia lots. I'll try to answer any questions you may have.
I'll ask a couple of questions first. We have a replat on consent. Why isn't this on consent agendas?
I believe it was removed at the request of a citizen.
Okay. The second question is, legal counsel has said for these issues that they are, what do they call them, ministerial acts that, and what does that mean?
There's a difference. So anytime you deal with land use, I think a lot of times people get confused between the zoning code and the subdivision code, two totally separate beasts when it comes to land use and how you govern land use. The zoning code actually governs true use of the land. And this is not a zoning decision that's before you tonight. This is a subdivision or a decision that falls underneath the subdivision code. Council has a great deal of discretionary authority when it comes to a legislative zoning act, but has limited discretion when it comes to a subdivision code decision. As long as a plat comes forward and it meets the standards that are set forth in the city code, the general rule in Missouri is that there's limited discretion to deny that act because the requirements, most simply put, are set forth in the subdivision code, and so staff reviews those requirements to determine if those technical requirements have been met.
Now, when you say limited discretion, you're not saying no discretion. There is a difference there. Because hypothetically, let me say I don't like the apartment complex.
It's not based on use. So when I say limited discretion, there has to be a reason underneath the subdivision code for denial of a subdivision plat, not based upon the use of the property, which is a zoning consideration. This isn't a request for rezoning. What they're actually requesting you to do is approve the physical layout of the lines on a piece of paper, and that's what a subdivision approval comes to you as, is approval of the physical lines. When it comes to denial of a request for a replat or a plat or a replat, the council's decision making needs to be focused on how those lines are laid out on the piece of paper, whether or not it's an appropriate configuration of the lot based upon where it's located within the city, whether or not it has a sufficient street layout, whether I'm trying to think of what else comes under the subdivision code, Tim, that you all take a look at, whether or not...
Well, whether we need right-of-way
for
the adjacent streets, public improvements, if public improvements are needed. I mean, there are improved streets fronting this property, so it does meet that test.
So in this particular request, it's already part of the original Town of Columbia, so the streets were already laid out. If you were considering a plat... that's on a green field, you'd probably be taking a lot closer look or should be taking a closer look at the traffic patterns and the layout of the lots to determine whether or not they make good sense from a decision-making standpoint. So when I say limited discretion, it really depends upon the various application that comes before you. And I haven't actually reviewed the specifics on this one. Staff has indicated that it meets the requirements of the subdivision code.
So what happens if we don't like the apartment building and we vote down the plat?
Use is not a consideration when determining whether or not you're going to approve a plat.
But what happens if we vote against it?
I guess we see.
Oh, is there potential liability there?
There is. There is potential liability on the part of the city.
Okay. In my role as city manager, that's... not just as a group. It's individual.
Yeah, it's individual, too. It can be individual.
It is. It's very rare that individual council members have liability for those kinds of actions, but it is always a possibility whenever something like this comes about.
Can I ask a couple of questions? And I would have pulled this off the consent agenda if someone else hadn't done it. And this is eerily reminiscent. This is like deja vu. Eerily reminiscent of the Walnut, East Walnut development that we had. And so I've got a couple questions embedded in this, not the least of which is, I mean, usually attorney, I'm not an attorney. You're the attorney. I respect attorneys' opinions, but there's a reason why they call them opinions, and there's a reason why in your opinions you say generally speaking or almost always or all of those kinds of things. And it's my understanding, at least, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we'll see how this discussion goes, that's all true. You're absolutely right. And believe me, I understand the distinction between use and subdivision stuff and the lines on a map and the use thing. So I'm not really going to get into the infrastructure thing and all the rest of it because that's already determined because of the C2 use that this already has had for a long period of time. However, and it's a big however, I think there is something that trumps all of this lines on a map stuff and all the rest of it, and it may even be worth risking it depends on how risky you want to be, I suppose, from a personal point of view. But it has to do with this idea of public health and welfare and how putting these lines on the map tonight leads us down the path to a decision that is not terribly, that there's a good deal of resistance in the public for whatever reason, whether it's a use reason or it's a line reason or anything else. And I'm just kind of trying to represent a little bit of what I have heard. So that begs the other question that I wanted to ask, and where is this 45-day thing? There's a 45-day window once you establish a final platting. And the last time we ran up across this, it was that East Walnut issue that our hands were tied to the extent that even if we wanted to do something, we were going to run across that 45-day window, and it was going to become the law anyway, regardless of what happened.
Right. We have a city code provision that requires you to act within 45 days. And if you continue it past, if you were to continue it by operation of law, it would be deemed approved. So you would want to go ahead and consider it and make a decision.
And that continuance.
Unless you have the consent of the applicant.
And that continuance applies to the potential for a tabling if that tabling would go beyond that 45 days. Is
yes,
that right?
Unless you have the consent of the applicant to do so. And at which point in time you could.
Where
continue.
Is this clock that we have? Where are we in with respect to this 45 days?
I'm not entirely sure of that. I'm sorry I didn't prepare an answer on it. They did apply sometime last year, and they took a delay on this at their own option. So it's been well past 45 days since the
I spoke
original
with,
application. They just placed this on hold for a period of time. And
I spoke with Mr. Fields this morning, and he said kind of in the end of it, we said, good luck with this. Hope you don't stay too late in the evening. So I don't know what that means. But I don't know if we're running up against the same kind of time constraint that we were before.
I can't answer that question. I do not know the answer to that.
Any other questions of staff?
Real quick, is this property on the Flat Branch Sewer? What sewer is this connected to? Flat Branch?
I believe it is. So, and they are going to, for the large project, the half block project, they're going to have to rehabilitate some sewers that run in that direction from the site, and that's based on the preliminary discussion of the sewer.
The capacity
utility.
Issue is resolved because we're in the process of extending the Flat Branch. And
yeah, there's not a capacity issue so much as condition or what I'd call the condition of the immediate adjacent sewers.
So typical of any other development, they have to take care of what abuts to their property.
Yeah, there'll be some off-site work. They have to make a decision of which branch sewer. They both lead to the same place, as I understand.
And so
it.
Then the electric issue is taken care of because we've worked on the Rebel Hill, so that capacity issue is resolved, correct, for electric capacity in the downtown area?
Yeah, the electric utility has indicated that they don't believe there's a problem. They do want to have the load calculations, and that'll be based on building data.
Okay.
And there's not such data available yet with this plant. They haven't submitted a building.
But any plan that they would come about in the future would have to conform to the capacity we have for the electric.
That's right, yeah. Or they have to remediate it themselves. Okay. So.
And then any stormwater issues they would have to
It's redevelopment. I think the amount of additional impervious is almost negligible. It's something like 0.51
acres. But they're not adding any more capacity to the existing.
And the existing condition is 0.49. So they'd have to do some water quality measures, I believe, is what the code says.
And then assuming anything that were to be built on this property would have to conform with the newly amended or recently amended C2 zoning?
Yeah, and again, they'll have to submit building plans that show that conformance. They have to be not less than 2, not more than 10 stories. They can exceed 10, but that would open up a whole other process of review by the Plan Commission and the council. There's a requirement for parking if they do apartments, so they've indicated to us, and there's some indication on the site development plan that has been submitted for. It's the half-acre site. I'll go back to see if I got a better graphic. Yep, just this one. This whole area here, which brings the whole mixed-use project site to about a half acre, there's an indication of second-story parking that they intend to ramp that in the vicinity of 10th in the alley. And then some retail units on 9th, but that's really the only indication of use as far as plan detail goes.
And so then any argument of public health relationship to sewer, electric, and stormwater is kind of negated because they have the capacity and the ability to have those essential services, correct?
Say that again.
That any so the argument of public health and safety and relationship to this zoning, or not zoning, excuse me, this plat, would be negated because they have access and capacity for sewer, electric, and stormwater, which are all.
To add 31 feet to the length of this lot does not pose an infrastructure issue. And that's how we're, that's our standard review for this. In fact, they're taking a parcel that really is almost landlocked. It does have alley access, and it's used for a parking area, so it's obviously accessed on a regular basis. But, you know, this considered in itself is a very minor change. It's part of a larger process that I sense the council and the public would like to be more part of. But this action is really just reconfiguring a lot.
Thank you.
Questions? Tim or Nancy, am I right in thinking that there is, although there's been discussion about a building to be built on this piece of property, is there a reference to that in the item that we're voting on, any of the parameters of a possible building?
No, this would be neutral as to use is how I'd describe it to you. In fact, if the former owner of the James Apartments wanted to add the 31 feet, they could have done this. They could have done it.
Adding 31 feet being the replatting that we're
doing? Yeah, they could have done this. They would have had to do this if they would have put a small structure in that rear area.
So they would have had to do this if they were putting a small structure, or right. They could have just done it without any plans to put any structure, although you might question why they would bother.
And then the building that's to the west, if that owner approached this owner and wanted to join those lots, it might be the same owner for all I know. You know, it would be a similar type action. We'd just reconfigure it as one lot, front on 9th instead of 10th. So,
okay,
it's really creating a different unit of real estate. You know, it's taking two, making them into one, and then the second significance of the action is it's making that last 31 feet buildable.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions?
So this is just expanding the James farther west, correct? Okay. Do you know why it was subdivided this way in the first place?
Well, you can see on the plat, the surveyor has shown all the detail on the block of, or some of the detail on the whole rest of the block. And I think these dashed lines indicate or approximate the original three 80-foot lots of the original town plat of Columbia. That's how not only this block, but all of the downtown blocks, several dozen, a couple dozen of them that were in the original town of Columbia, that's how they were subdivided, three with an alley in between, and they were all uniform. And over time, there's been resurvey of those lots, and they've been assembled and divided in different ways. And ESNS was able to provide documentation of recorded surveys documenting all of those transfers with the exception of this 31 feet. So that's the part that doesn't qualify for a legal lot under the code for building.
Okay, and then the second question for that is sort of following up on Laura's question. So I understand that whoever builds here, and that we don't have plans, but well, sooner or later, that they're going to have to connect the sewer to our, to the city sewer line. But the city sewer line then goes down to Flat Branch, where, you know, we're cutting down trees and we're putting bigger sewers in. Are those sewers going to be in place by the time that this building would be ready for occupancy, or are we going to have the same discussion about whether we have enough sewer capacity?
Well,
or not?
I'm trying to recall my completion dates for both. I know the development project is scheduled to be done summer of 17.
Mr. Mathis, you have any idea when this sewer project is going to be done? Or I don't see any of your other guys out there.
Yes, it should be done in time for a if this is going to be a 10-story building, it'll have to be steel and concrete, and that takes a bit longer than wood, and we're building the sewers now, so it's
so adding the 400 toilets to this, to the sewer line we have, plus the 900, is it, at the ACC, is it? Because that's all going in the same sewer line, right? So we will have capacity for that. We won't be in trouble with the EPA.
Yeah.
Mike, assuming a building permit request comes in for a 10-story building or whatever, describe the process that you or other staff go through to assess infrastructure capacity as well as compliance with zoning.
Well, we've, as you'll remember, last year in the budget, we sort of reorganized a bit, and we really unified that set of utilities. And so now all the utilities look at it in a comprehensive way. In fact, you just saw evidence of that last meeting where we're going to dig up Elm for the sewer, but we said, okay, what else needs to happen? So there were seven projects that we're doing together, so we repave once. That's the whole point of the reorg, and I'm glad to see it's already working in that regard. So the process is we all do our individual speciality, whether that's stormwater or sewer or electric or any of the utilities, and then we also come together. And so we end up either giving it as a staff from the plans a thumbs up or a thumbs down about whether we have the capacity to handle that. Tim's staff and others then communicate with the applicant and say yes or no based on, you know, their expertise and their purview. So you might get a yes on electric and a no on sewer, or vice versa in theory, and then we expect the applicant to either fix that problem and come back with a plan that addresses it, or they simply abandon the project if it's too expensive, for example. So
to fix the problem could be to reduce the number or the amount of use.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Or in the previous projects, you'll remember they might be willing to build water line at their expense,
right,
to get the right amount of water
pressure.
Provide
extra capacity.
Right. And so that's all up to the builder, mm-hmm, and their choices about how they want to go about fixing any particular problem.
And for each utility, you have data showing how much capacity it has altogether for this area and how much is currently utilized, and therefore how much is available to be allocated. And when a building permit is issued that uses some of that capacity, then the current available capacity is updated.
That's right. We track all of that. Everything's case by case, so each site has a little bit different numbers involved in it, but we do check all those utilities, and we keep track of the capacities. And as you know painfully well, we reject projects that we can't serve, and sometimes that's not a popular decision, and sometimes when we fix those problems, it's equally unpopular. So our role is just to say yes or no, we have it or we don't. Now, in this case, there's a lot of hypotheticals from what we hear might be coming, but we don't have specific building plans about what might be coming. So we're, on a hypothetical level, there is capacity for what we've heard might be coming.
And you have a specific process that you will go through when a request for a building permit comes.
That's right.
Thank you.
I have two questions. First question, if we approve the replatting tonight, then is there a possibility that going forward that the city council will have any say about what is actually built on that property?
Once the use question comes up, it really depends on if they follow all of the rules previous councils have established for this zoning, for this use. If they follow all the rules, it will not come back to you. If they want to vary from those, it will come back to you. So it's really up to them about whether it lands on your table or not. If they follow all the rules, then the staff is bound by the ordinance. We don't have decision-making power. We say yes or no, it meets the rules or it doesn't. So then what comes after that is if they get the approval, there are two things that would come back. One is a sidewalk closure request, and one's a street closure request, potentially. So if they wanted to close a street while they built, that's a common request you get when these sort of things happen. For example, that was granted for the building on 9th and Elm, the Shakespeare's building. Mm-hmm. And we also close the sidewalk, really, and that's a protection for the public so they don't get too close to the construction project. So that's generally why it comes back to you and why you grant them. But everything's case by case. So it's everything from that's the least amount of decision-making you'll have in the foreseeable future, and then up to quite a detailed amount of decision-making if the builder wants to vary from the law.
My second question is, since this is a subdivision code, based on a subdivision code, could you just review some of the criteria that's within the code so that I can have a better idea of how they have complied with those criteria?
Give a real general overview, and then I'll ask the really knowledgeable folks to weigh in on that. Subdivision at its core is truly just what you look at here. It's lines on a map, and we try to organize our community based on, okay, this is a lot or that's a lot, and I can come back, and if I own two lots, I can combine them into one, or I can subdivide them into four. And there are rules about how small you can get, how big you can get, but there are rules about how small you can get and create a lot. In this particular case, you basically have a parking lot behind an apartment building. It's always or traditionally been used as the parking lot for that building, although they never bothered to combine the lots. In fact, they hadn't, near as we can tell, hadn't created a lot. So that's why this gets triggered, that they have to go through that process. And so this is to create one lot, one buildable piece of property, basically. So that's the generalities I'll share with you. Tim, Nancy, anything you want to add to?
Well, the survey information has to be accurate, and every plat review usually includes an exchange between the staff and the surveyor that prepared the plat, and usually have to correct some errors or inaccuracies or omissions or operate with a different understanding of how those are calculated. And in this case, we're reporting to you that all those standards have been met for accuracy. So what's going to be recorded is, in our best judgment, an accurate representation of a piece of real estate. Suppose an applicant said, we don't want to make that change. I could imagine there'd be a conversation with the council where we'd say, we're disagreeing here about how the boundaries are being described. We recommend denying the plat. I mean, that's probably one of the reasons these things do go to council. The other standards would be lot area and width, but in the C2 district, there isn't a prescribed minimum or maximum lot width, nor is there a minimum area. So that's really just a general checkoff that we look at, but it's going to be more important in a residential district where there are minimums, for example. Presence or absence of services, is the infrastructure available? And, you know, it's improved property here, so we look at that standard as being met. And as I said, we're not looking at this. It's about a 0.2 acre parcel. We're not looking at it as the entirety of the development site that we know about from our conversations. We're really just looking at any issues that it presents for that apartment building site and the parking lot behind it.
Thanks. That's clear.
I'm going to just add two things. On a re-subdivision, which is what this is called, the city code actually calls for two things. It actually says a re-subdivision of land shall not be approved by the council. If the council determines that, one, the replat would eliminate restrictions on the existing plat upon which neighboring property owners or the city have relied. And I don't think there's any indication from staff that there are any current restrictions that will be eliminated. Or two, the replat would be detrimental to other property in the neighborhood, and the detriment to the property in the neighborhood outweighs the benefits to the subdivider and the public. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with what the ultimate use of the property would be and whether or not you feel like the ultimate use of the property would be detrimental. It has to do with whether or not the physical layout of the property is detrimental, meaning it wouldn't be advisable to combine these two tracks for the benefit of public health, safety, and welfare, and I don't think staff has any indication as to any detriment that would be provided by combining those two. So that's specific to re-subdivision.
I have seen that in my career, and it's usually been where something was combined and blocked other property from access to utilities. So I've seen those get rejected on that basis.
Let me dig into that just a bit, particularly that second point. And I can understand this from an access point of view. But and since we've been talking about hypotheticals, we might as well go a little bit further and talk about hypotheticals here. If we came to the conclusion that in some fashion, not talking about use, but there is something detrimental about this idea of combining these pieces of property, let me ask you this question, I guess it is. If this did not happen, if these lots were not combined, I suppose we would get accused of a taking, right? Because people couldn't do what they want to do on the property that they have if there wasn't sufficient reason to talk about public health and safety with regard to this hypothetical about what's going to happen here and we have no idea about, right? I mean, am I right in that assumption? I mean, if we didn't do this, then we would risk that kind of activity from the developers.
I'm not going to presuppose what a cause of action would be.
Could happen.
Could writ of mandamus could happen. There are a number of causes of action, and I just wouldn't want to opine as to that into a public setting as to what those causes of action would be.
Well, let me ask two other things. Well, I've got everybody here. Two things. One is about, it was mentioned that electric is now being handled from the Rebel Hills substation, and that was an accommodation for ACC and some other things when they revised their thing down. Does the recent hold on the transmission line issue have any bearing as to how Rebel Hills might supply the kind of downtown energy, I mean, in terms of the future? Is that an issue at all until that gets resolved in terms of electricity, or we're in good shape for electricity as far as this is concerned?
We're in good shape at the moment. So the transmission line
We just don't know what the moment is because it's all hypothetical, right?
But so if you wind the clock back, you remember the conversation about connecting the dots. So the substation are the dots. As you connect them, it provides more capacity everywhere.
Sure.
And so that's a future benefit for downtown. It's also a future benefit for west, south, and east. And there's our utility director. I'll ask Ted to come get specific. But my understanding, Ted, is we won't run out of the capacity that Rebel Hill freed up.
Right. This project was basically analyzed with what we have now, mm-hmm. basically in place right now. So there is enough resources right now to allow this project to go forward. Like Tim had said, we're still needing load calculations and riser diagrams sure. on it, but based upon what you would typically see from this type of facility, the answer is we should not have a problem based on where we are now. There's no future projects that we're waiting for that to show up for this to happen.
Okay, I appreciate that. One other, go ahead.
Yeah, and I just want to say that, until staff actually has a chance to take a look at those, I mean, I don't think that there's any indication, and if there's a developer that's going to be bringing a project forward, what Tad is saying is they need to still see those calculations. He can't opine, nor should a developer rely upon staff's comments tonight as to adequacy
okay,
of infrastructure, because I think it's very important that they have the opportunity to take a look at the actual building permit application and those right. projected utilizations. Now, that said, what the subdivision code requires is for staff to determine, is infrastructure available to the site? Not is the infrastructure adequate for any particular project at any particular point in time.
Right.
So is there a sewer service adjacent to the site or within a reasonable location? A lot of times you don't see property develop on the fringes of the city, and subdivisions don't get approved on the fringes of the city because there really isn't mm-hmm. sewer available. So that's when staff reviews the subdivision code for availability of infrastructure, it has to do with, is there just access? Not is it adequate to serve a particular project at a particular point in time. So maybe that helps, maybe it doesn't. But the point being, when you're dealing with a replat of property, at some point in time, the infrastructure has already been provided. Now, given the intensity of a project, you might have to have more right-of-way dedication based upon traffic movements, those kinds of things, or larger pipes, but that's going to depend upon building permit application.
Right. So, Ted, when you said that the electrical connections were there, you weren't referring to any particular building plan, merely to the access to an electrical service.
Correct.
Thank you.
And one final question, I hope it's final question, and that has to do, one of the issues that didn't come up has to do with the amount of control, for example, that council does or does not have moving forward. In addition to building permitting and all that kind of thing, we also, the demolition aspect and the historical preservation aspect, potential historical preservation aspect, bears on this as well. Does anybody want to comment on how that demolition permitting system would work in this case once this plat, assuming this plat would go forward?
Yeah, we do have the permit applications for not only the James building, but the Britches, the clothing store, and the Quinton's. So those are now going into that 30-day period of notice to the Historic Preservation Commission. I think there's been some reaching out between a member of the HPC and Mr. Fields, who's the principal of the Rise.
Heard that. We actually talked about that this morning as well. He was amenable to that. But yeah,
so that process is underway. I wouldn't anticipate they'd demo at the end of the 30 days. I think they're probably going to allow some time for leases to run their course and that kind of thing. But
yeah, having talked to, I'll just interject here, Pat Fowler sent me an email, and that she had been talking to Mr. Fields, and they're fine with letting them go in there, take pictures, take out what they need, so they're planning a weekend, and they're getting that all organized. So they've done a good job with historic preservation, and they're getting along.
Any other questions?
I'll open up the public hearing. Would anyone like to speak?
Good evening. My name is Matthew Crudy. I'm with Engineering Surveys and Services, offices at 1113 Fay Street. I'm the civil engineer on the project and representing the owner on this as well.
You need 5 minutes, or is 3 minutes enough?
I'll be used less than three.
Thank you.
This has been beat up pretty good already.
Thank you.
There's a couple items I wanted to highlight. One, in terms of the application time frame, as Mr. Teddy had noted, you know, we have delayed significantly already. I know it hadn't made it here to council at that point, but we had agreed to continue to delay that. Just looking back, this is already was first read at the previous council meeting, and then you back up time for advertising and such. I mean, I think we're well in 30, 35 plus days already into the process now as we sit here today. Second, you know, again, I'll highlight again, the plat meets all guidelines and requirements of the re-subdivision ordinance. And, you know, client is not interested in continuing to table this or push this off any longer. And lastly, I guess I just do my little Google search on ministerial requirements. I'm no lawyer, and I'm not going to claim to be one. Ministerial duty refers to the official duty of a public officer wherein the officer has no room for the exercise of discretion and the performance being required by direct and positive command of the law. So the only thing I note is there is no discretion in that consideration. How that applies, again, I'm no lawyer, so I'll stop there. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
My name is John Clark. I live at 403 North 9th Street. And, of course, I inundated the council with questions about this, but it's mainly questions about the degree of discretion and whether it was the same as in the preliminary versus final plat situation. The council probably has not chosen to get outside legal opinion on that. But I do remember with Parkside, when there was a final plat, you decided to attach a condition. And so I would actually, and we've had a lot of talk that's not about the subdivision rules, but about actually the process about adequacy of resources and so forth. What has been forgotten by many of you is that everybody says, well, when we finish these new pipelines and relief sewers, we'll have adequate dry weather capacity. We aren't going to have adequate wet weather capacity. And so what I would like to suggest, and I direct this primarily to Mr. Ruffin, hopefully to his, is that as a condition of this plat, and certainly later on as a condition of a determination of sufficiency that the council will direct, that you attach a condition to this plat that the measure of adequate capacity for stormwater and sanitary sewer be based on wet weather capacity, and that means that at the time this building comes online, doesn't matter whether you have enough dry weather capacity, in the Flat Branch Basin, if it's reasonably foreseeable that sewer backups in basements, manhole, all those kind of things will continue, that it will be a determination that it lacks the capacity. Now, I would like to have that attached as a condition to approval of the plat, in the same way that were conditions attached to the Parkside plat that we debated endlessly about the 15% impervious. But that told me that, in fact, such conditions could be applied. So I would recommend that with that condition attached that you approve this reconsolidation. Would you like me to state it again? Now, you ought to reword it, and I'm not interested in somebody rewording my words out. I would like to see that the condition, the standard for measuring sanitary sewer and stormwater capacity, because with the I&I they're related, be a wet weather standard based on the likelihood of sewer backups, blowing manholes, and so forth within, and I'm thinking mainly of the Flat Branch, but in fact, somebody may be aware, in First Ward, there is also a county house branch. There are other branches and stormwaters. They may not feed into this. But I would recommend that and ask you to consider doing it. And this wouldn't be over that, but that would solve the problem for me, because I don't think we're going to match that by the time they're going to build. I don't have a feeling one way or the other about the building itself. I do have a great deal of feeling about continuing to build stuff that continues to harm the people in my neighborhood, in the central city, do these backups by these endless runarounds to allow development to go ahead before those things are fixed.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
And thank you for the extra time, Mayor.
Anyone else? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. I'm going to start. I'm going to follow the advice of legal counsel, and I'm going to view this as certifying that this is a legal plat. And so I'm going to vote for this issue. It remains to be seen if staff believes that this project will comply with the interim C2 rules and regulations which we've passed. It remains to be seen if the staff has determined that the infrastructure capacity is there. And it remains to be seen what the Historic Preservation Commission says, although, you know, they have limited ability to stop demolition, but they certainly had used public opinion to save the Niedermeyer building. So on that basis, I'm going to take a narrow approach to this and say this appears to me to be a legal plat, and I'm going to vote to approve it. It's in your ward, Ms. Council Member Ruffin. Do you have any? You want to go next?
Sure, yeah. I just listening, and it seems to be a legal decision as well. And I'm not sure, out of respect to Mr. Clark, is it possible to place this requirement on this decision?
Actually, any kind of condition that you put onto a plat has to be definable and reasonably related to the plat itself.
Okay.
In this particular instance, I don't think that we would be able to define what it is that he's requested you to do in order to determine whether or not it's like attaching a development right to a plat as opposed to focusing on the physical layout of the property. Okay. So adequacy of the sanitary sewer and the stormwater structures come at the time of building permit issuance, not at platting.
Yeah, that was my understanding as well. Thank you.
Okay.
I agree with what my two colleagues have said. When we became council members, we took an oath to support the law. The law is very clear on this.
Councilor?
Thank
you,
all been said.
Well, I'm not sure the law is very clear on this. I mean, we obviously had an opinion from the city attorney, and I appreciate the fact that the rest of the council has weighed in on this, because I sure would hate to fall on a sword and get out there. And I was thinking, you know, since I was the first to vote, I might have to do this. But I will tell you that I take my responsibilities as a representative very seriously, and I get the distinction between the zoning and the subdivision regs and the lines on the map and all the rest of this, and we've talked about this for some period of time now. I'm still very uncomfortable, and I have to go to sleep tonight, and I want to make sure that I make a decision whether or not I risk some sort of lawsuit, private lawsuit. I mean, should this thing, I mean, and I think we would risk that perhaps if this went down. But I will tell you, I hate this process. I do not like this process that we have to base our decision making on a hypothetical that we may or may not know is coming, and put all these eggs in one basket that depend on somebody else making all these decisions who are not elected officials and who don't represent some of the folks. Now, I'm all for negotiation between, and I spoke with Mr. Fields this morning. He's a wonderful guy. We had a long conversation, more than a half an hour. He's very willing to deal with historical preservation, all the rest of this. Feels bad about the idea that he had to give notice to some of these folks as early as he did. I get all that.
But the overwhelming sentiment that a lot of folks have been telling me, that who I represent, is what is going on downtown? I mean, I have a bit of a record for voting against some of these things because of infrastructure issues and all the rest of it. And a lot of people are coming up with the final question saying, well, what's left for the adults downtown? And what about the ramifications? I know that it has nothing to do with this, right? But just so that I can go to sleep tonight, I'm going to vote no.
Mr. Thomas.
I'm going to vote yes. I was very confused early in my term on council when the East Walnut project came up, new to the process and trying to unpick what was discretionary and what wasn't. It is pretty clear to me at this point that the vote we're being asked to take tonight is completely separate from any discussions of use on that property. And so I feel very comfortable approving the replatting that has been requested from a process point of view. And I think it's really important that we follow good processes, or at least the processes that we have. And if we don't like the process we have, we should change the processes rather than attack individual projects. But there are a lot of concerns about the project that has been proposed, 10-story building on that site, ranging from whether it complies with zoning to infrastructure capacity and historic preservation. As far as the zoning's concerned, I have seen a proposal. Mr. Field came and met with me a few weeks ago. It appears to comply with our C2 interim zoning in that it is no higher than 10 stories, in that it does include 25% parking spaces per the number of beds that are proposed, and also that it has retail on the ground floor. So I was pretty happy with most elements of the C2 interim zoning that we approved a couple of years ago. So I would feel comfortable that if the project, when it comes, complies with that, that is consistent. Another thing I kind of like, which is different from most of the downtown apartment buildings that have come recently, is that two-thirds of the units will be either studios, one-bedroom apartments, or two-bedroom apartments, which is a lot different from catering to the undergraduate student market. And it does mean this building will have some appeal for other markets. And people have said, well, would somebody who's not a student want to really live in a building with students? And I think I'd be okay with that. I think that would be kind of fun. Infrastructure capacity, again, that's not a question for now. That'll be a question, and we just heard the city manager explain the process if and when a building permit comes for this property or any other that the staff will go through to determine whether there's infrastructure capacity in each of those different utility systems. Now, this also was confusing a couple of years ago because there were some mixed messages about infrastructure capacity downtown, and I think those have been over time clarified. But I am interested in John's suggestion, and I'm not going to support an attaching this to the platting decision. But what would your ruling be? Would you look at sewer capacity if and when a building permit comes in wet weather or dry weather conditions?
We look at both, of course, because our problem is when it's wet. He's absolutely right. So if it never rained, we wouldn't have a problem. So we'd look at it through the wet weather standard. It's got to have enough capacity when it rains and not result in more sanitary sewer overflows for us to approve it. With the flat branch projects, it's very likely it will pass that test.
Okay. So it'll be the wet weather capacity that you'll look at if and when a building permit comes in. Good. And historic preservation, certainly the developer has been very cooperative on all of the issues that people have been concerned about and the opportunity to recover items. There is a historic building, or at least there's an old building on the property. Deb Shields told me that it's the 121 South 10th Street was the Wynn Hotel and also Elks Lodge number 594, built around 1903. A highly intact two-story colonial revival four-square with a hipped roof and brick walls. And there's a lot of value to preserving historic buildings in downtown Columbia and throughout the community, although most of them are in downtown Columbia. We had a presentation from Brian Treese and Robert Tucker a couple of months ago in response to a question that I made. Is how what suggestions do you have for policy approaches to providing stronger protections for historic buildings? And they presented a number of items, and I have responded to them privately, and we're discussing some possible ways to move forward. I think one of the critical things is a clear definition of a historic building that we would agree on, that would be written into some kind of an ordinance. At the moment, the entire downtown district, I believe it's 150 buildings or so, is part of a historic district. But that includes a lot of buildings that are not historic buildings. And so the definitions are kind of a little unclear at the moment. But I do think it's important to continue that process. And there are a number of good suggestions that they came up with that I'd like to pursue. But I am happy in this very technical legal case to support a replatting as proposed.
Councilmember Pierce.
I am happy to support it because it appears to be, as you say, just a legal replatting. But I'd also be supportive that we do need to make sure that when it rains, we would have enough sewer capacity, not just when it's dry. Although I do appreciate the amount we've been able to pull out of the stormwater, out of the sewers. So,
please call the roll.
Council Bill 2116, Mr. Scala?
No.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Snauzer?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
B2216.
Council Bill 2216 is an ordinance approving the Discovery Office Park North CP plan, authorizing an intergovernmental cooperation agreement with Discovery Park Transportation Development District, NP 1316 LLC, and fixing the time when this ordinance shall become effective. Second reading.
Staff, please.
As read by the clerk, this ordinance would do two things. It would approve a CP or Plan Business District site plan entitled Discovery Office Park North. And that plan is on about 5 acres of land at the far north end of what's known as Discovery and has been known as the Phillips Farm Tract as well. And there'd be 4 one-story office buildings built on that 5-acre parcel, totaling about 50,000 square feet of space under roof, each building, I think, averaging at about 11,250 square feet. Second part of the council bill authorizes the city manager to execute an intergovernmental cooperation agreement with Discovery Park Transportation Development District and the developer, which goes by the LLC P1316. That intergovernmental agreement recognizes that a Transportation Development District has already been formed. It's about 2 years old, a little beyond 2 years now. And it acknowledges that a reference in the ordinance that granted the original annexation and rezoning that required a development agreement, that this would fulfill that. And it also indicates that TDD revenues may be used for certain of the transportation infrastructure improvements throughout Discovery. Hope I captured that, Ms. Counselor.
Questions from council.
Try to answer questions.
Yeah, so I'm the one who pulled this off, and my questions were mainly the TDD. Do we ever, so it's more of a general question, really. Who is responsible for the monies that are collected there, and do they also have to come back every 5 years with a, you know, with any kind of accountability as to what they've acquired and when they are finished building? Because The agreement I saw was dated 2015, but didn't have a date. I mean, didn't really have a date except for that year, and it didn't have a timeline or when it would expire. So those were my questions, really. And I don't know who I should be directing that to.
Right. So I don't recall off the top of my head, and I didn't bring all of the information on this particular TDD with me to see when it actually expires, if it's one that goes for 20 or 21 years. It
doesn't appear to have an expiration date in the paperwork.
I don't recall off the top of my head, but it's actually a separate taxing jurisdiction. So they don't have a five-year report to the city council. This is the intergovernmental agreement that governs where the priority of the funds that they collect will go and what expenses they'll pay first for public infrastructure improvements out of the TDD, the Intergovernmental Cooperative Agreement.
And we don't oversee the TDD.
No. I'm sorry?
We don't oversee the TDD.
No, you don't oversee the TDD.
But the money that they collect?
They have to keep track of it and report to whatever state jurisdiction agency that's responsible for it.
And it's the right, state, correct, that gives the go-ahead for any TDD to become, has jurisdiction over all TDDs and gives them the statutory authority to create one, and they're governed by state statutes, not local statutes.
Correct? They're a governmental entity just like the city is. So it's just the boundaries of their district are the boundaries of the TDD, and I don't have a copy of the map, but it is a public entity subject to sunshine laws, subject to all of the laws that govern the operation of a transportation development district.
So they do have board requirements, meeting requirements, and they do have the power to tax, and so they're generally only used on retail-type developments where there's a transaction occurring that you can tax. The sale of. So then they're generally, in the name, transportation. You can only use that tax to build roads and in some cases into the parking lot a little bit. A good example of a TDD that's worked well is actually on Stadium. So there's actually a series of TDDs that have all been used to fund that repavement and all that reconstruction from right there by the mall, the stadium, to Broadway.
There are some TDDs that didn't work out quite so well.
Right. don't make much money.
Yeah, and the other interesting side note, is that for a long time there was a historical promise to keep that taxing level at about 0.5%, and some of them have since raised it to 1%. So when we sometimes get a bit of criticism about how high the sales tax is in this community in terms of the city, we're really only responsible for about 2%, and some of these independent groups like TDDs and CID and various others increase that. So that's part of the issue.
And they don't have a higher limit to how?
They do have a 1% limit.
A 1%, okay. Thank you.
And I'll add that Exhibit C that is in that agreement is what was part of the judgment or order out of the circuit court creating the TDD that sets forth the transportation projects that will be constructed by the district. So that's consistent with the court order establishing the transportation development district. And it starts on page 28 of what's in your packet.
Thank you. I was going to ask you what. I'm like, there's 44 pages
right,
here.
So it starts on page 28, and it's Exhibit C.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Would anyone of the public like to speak? Seeing none, any more discussion by council? Please call the roll.
Council Bill 2216. Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Ms. Nowser?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Please read the consent agenda bills.
Items on the consent agenda include bills 2016, 24, 16, 25, 16, 26, 16, 27, 16, 28, 16, 29, 16, 30, 16, and resolutions 15, 16, 16, 16, 17, 16, 19, 16, and 2016.
Please call the roll.
Bills 2016, 24, 16, 25, 16, 26, 16, 27, 16, 28, 16, 29, 16, 30, 16, and resolutions 15, 16, 16, 16, 17, 16, 19, 16, and 2016. Mr. Scala.
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Mr. Thomas.
Yes.
Ms. Nauzer?
Yes, on all bills and resolutions.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. McDavid?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes. Please read R18-16.
Council Bill 1816 is a resolution authorizing the installation of streetlights along portions of Whispering Pine Way, Providence Road, and Derby Ridge Drive.
Staff, please.
The staff street lighting committee has received three requests for street lights outside of water and light service territory, which means they're in Boone Electric service territory. These three requests are one, the first one is the installation of one, a single post-top luminaire at the end of Whispering Pines Way. The second request that's coming forward is the installation of 16 street lights along Providence Road north of Brown School Road. And the third and final is the installation of seven post-top luminaires along Derby Ridge Drive, also north of Brown School Road. The staff street lighting committee has reviewed these requests and recommended installing the lights as detailed in this request. So with that, to answer any questions about this request.
Yeah, I asked to have this pulled off the consent agenda, not because I disagree with the staff's location of some of these things. I just remember we went through, I guess it was about 1999 to 2006, getting an outdoor lighting ordinance in effect, and we purposefully in that ordinance stipulated that we weren't going to take on street lighting. That was a different deal, and it had to do with, again, public health and safety and so on. But we have since tweaked it a little bit, taken a look at it in terms of the efficiencies of lighting, for example, in the large garage on 5th and Walnut and so on, to tone some of those things down and deal with shielding and so on. My question here is, since we have kind of blown into the new era with all kinds of LEDs on all kinds of lighting applications, and there are even some issues downtown about the intensity of some of the lights because they're LEDs and shielding and so on. My question is, low-pressure sodium lights here historically are very inefficient, and LEDs are much more efficient. And I understand the problems involved in some of the inventory, and we have some inventory on hand that you typically want this consistent with the other stuff that we have in place. Have we looked into the possibility of starting to shift over to LEDs for effective, safe street lighting?
We do. When we have to go replace street lighting in our service territory, typically we will be putting up LEDs these days. These are in Boone Electric service territory, so we'll be using Boone Electric lights. I understand they have some test lights they're working with, but they don't have an LED option.
So the Whispering Pines, which is in the third ward, but that in fact is a Boone service territory.
Correct. So these are all we can do is ask or not ask for Boone Electric to put the lights up, and this is their standard right now. I would expect they'll go to have that option someday. This is just all they have now.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Would anyone in the public like to speak? Any more discussion?
Yes, Mayor. I appreciate Mr. Scala pulling this from the consent agenda. I was going to comment it during council comments section. Two of these are in the second ward, a long-time request on Providence Road. It's very dark out there. That's really going to add to safety, especially at the intersection where Providence comes into that busy street whose name is escaping me. Brown School Road, maybe.
Brown School Road.
And then the seven streetlights along Derby Ridge Drive north of Brown School Road really gives me hope in the efficacy of the strategic plan, because that is that request isn't 2-3 weeks old, and we're passing a law and we'll be moving towards installing streetlights, because that is near Arbor Hills Park. There's a lot of crime area. It was brought to city staff's attention that it was very dim. I went and checked it out, found it very dim, that there's troublesome elements that congregate in the dark there by the park, and within weeks, which is like, I've never seen government act like that. So I do believe the strategic plan means something, and that we're looking at the way that we're doing things across the board, because we have limited police resources, and there's a cry out for help and increased public safety, and we're putting some streetlights in. So that's thank you. I'm very impressed.
Any other comments?
Just one additional comment. I'd be remiss to say this. As involved as I was in this outdoor lighting thing, and certainly I am not referring to street lights because we need this in terms of safety, and it's an entirely different ballgame when it comes to traffic and so on. But, you know, this whole idea about brighter is better is kind of it's paradoxical. Because even the police department, to some degree, will suggest to you that if the lights are far too bright in some, for example, gas station canopies, that kind of thing, it's not useful light. It's the kind of light that can even thwart the witness identification that's necessary for the police to function properly, either looking into the stores or out of the stores or whatever. You can have lights that are too bright. We're not doing that with street lights. I'm not even suggesting this, and I'm on board with you as well that we really do need some of these improvements, and this is pretty remarkable. But folks ought to keep this in mind, that there is functional, usable light that would help in terms of crime prosecution, and there is light that can serve just the opposite purpose.
Please call the roll.
Councilbill 1816, Mr. Scala?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Mouser?
Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mr. David?
Yes.
Mr. Ruffin?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
Please read the introduction and first reading bills.
All bills are introduced by the mayor unless otherwise indicated. Bills 3116, 3216, 3316, 3416, 3516, 3616, 3716, 3816, 3916, 4016, 4116, 4216, 4316, 4416, 4416, 4516, 4416, 4616, and 4716, first reading.
Report 1216 refers to the New Century Fund Board, of which the mayor is a member. It was established about 15 years ago as a vehicle for philanthropy for city programs. Basically, if somebody as a memorial wants to give $5,000 to the park, you know, this is, they hold it until it's dispersed. So it was set up as that. 2003, they increased the size of the board to 10 members, and there's not a lot of activity on it right now. The Community Foundation has taken over a lot of the larger philanthropic issues for the city. And so the board wants to downsize it back to the 7 it really was before, and they want to do it by attrition. And so on that basis, I'm going to move that the city clerk cease advertising for new members of the City of Columbia New Century Fund until further notice, which may be communicated to the council in October of 2016 when they're down to 7.
I'll second that.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Report 1316 is a report on neighborhood traffic management. It's an annual report. Staff?
Yeah, the neighborhood traffic management program was implemented in November of 2013. It was set up to streamline and prioritize our traffic calming projects. And on an annual basis, we bring a report to council with a list of potential traffic calming projects. However, due to current staffing levels, only about 2 to 3 projects ranking the highest using a scoring system developed to ensure the projects are prioritized in a fair and equitable manner are able to be completed. Most of the project scores stayed in the same range this year as the previous report. However, new speed data for Stewart Road and Rollins Road brought significant changes to the score sheet, with Stewart Road now ranking as first priority and Rollins Road as fourth priority. As indicated in the report, the top 3 traffic calming projects are Stewart Road, Sexton Road, and Rice Road, to include Kelsey Drive. However, staff has received requests to move 3 other projects to the top of the list, and these are West Parkway, currently ranked 32nd on their list, Rollins Road, which I mentioned was 4th, and Heritage Meadows, which is 30th on the list. But unless directed otherwise, what staff would like to do is follow the prioritization in the report. One thing I do want to mention is in the ballot that was passed in August, council allowed us to increase our traffic calming program. And those funds actually started being generated in January. So we'll have actually a revenue stream that we've never had before. And so what staff is intended to do is look at a consultant to help accelerate these projects quicker. I have two traffic engineers for all the issues in the city right now, and this is just an area that is so time intensive when you get into these type of things. So we're asking to let the program kind of build up, let us go out with a strategy, if you will, to fund these. When you do hire a consultant, that does take away asphalt and hard traffic calming, but so it's a priority that we need to weigh against the timing of some of these versus, you know, the money where it's spent. So that's something that we'll continue the discussion with council on.
Is there, I know some of these things are rather costly. I was just looking at the sheer number that are in the fifth ward. Now, granted, a lot of them don't score as high as some of these other priorities. But are there other things that we can do that maybe don't cost as much, you know, such as, you know, those solar-powered speed signs that flash when you're speeding?
Right, and if
so, it doesn't have to be something you have to go in and redo the roadbed, or you know, put in speed humps or speed tables, something that would be less costly, and or even things that could be moved around.
Correct, and there's level one highlights, and there's a sheet in the report. I think it's page 6, and it it does list the what they call the low hanging fruit attempts at without having to spend a lot of money, and those are coming in mainly through a petition process that was developed in the program itself. And so there are interim measures that seem to work, and then if they do not, then we continue the next step, the level 2, level 3 analysis. So
it seems like that would be a good use of some of these funds, since we have that steady stream.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe purchase more of those types of things and leave them there longer, just because I think you change people's behaviors. You're not going to change a behavior over a course of a week with something like that, but maybe over a course of a month, so people get into the habit of driving slower. And so that would be my suggestion, because I know I'm not going to get anything moved up, obviously, with the scoring matrix as it is, because that's the most fair and unbiased way to address these problems and take politics and things out of it. So I certainly would like to see more Fifth Ward projects up there, but I certainly understand the need to have, you know, these number one and high priorities done first.
Just a question. I thought you said you wanted to take politics out of it, but then you. I'm just saying.
Well, I could sit here and argue. And
no, it's just.
And bring a contingent of people down here to say.
But my question really had to do with this new revenue stream, because I thought we had put something in the budget for this. Yeah, I know it's very early. Do we have any expectations for this, and how much revenue are we generating above and beyond what we used to generate? And just a guesstimate ballpark, if we can accommodate another project or two, I don't know.
Over the 10 years, it's slated for $1.8 million.
And how much does, I know there's no average cost for a speed table or something, but what are we really talking about here?
The speed humps are maybe around $10,000.
Is that right?
Something like that. Table will be a little bit longer, a little more expensive. We've been able to do most of those in-house. We went out for a bid to get what we call like a term and supply, and we had absolutely no bidders on that. I think it's just a case-by-case scenario on how they're going to be put in, where, and it's a really, even just putting those in, you have to have a lot of public feedback. A lot of people don't want them in front of their house.
That's, yeah, right.
And so, you know, it takes a whole lot of...
It's almost a neighborhood effort.
That's right.
I've got a few questions, but before I start on those, I'm going to ask that we don't give approval to proceed with this particular proposal or change it at the moment, because I believe there are some people here that want to testify on this, and because it came through as a report, there was no natural opportunity for them to do that, and I'd like them to have that opportunity during open comments, and then we can discuss it during our comments, or we can leave it to another meeting.
Could we bring it back as an ordinance or a resolution of some kind?
I mean, I would...
Bring
no.
It back on.
Yes.
Yeah, whatever you need.
Okay.
If you bring it back as a resolution, there'll be public comment.
Yes. typical approach is to tell us you want to see some of this come back or you don't. Okay. If you do, then it opens up to public comment.
And then we can listen to the folks anyway.
Before the project happens.
Right, and they'll be able to speak tonight and again. You're not going to be mean and say they can't speak a second time.
I'm hoping you'll bring it back after April sometime.
So let me get to a few questions. I really like this program. I think you've worked really hard to come up with a fair way to take into account all of these factors. Just to get a sense of the scope of the program, you're doing sort of two or three level two or level three projects each year.
Oh, that's correct.
And how many level ones do you get to work on?
Like I mentioned on page
and those are the ones that you're
six,
talking about,
there
signage
may be
and
15 to 20 or something.
Okay,
like that.
Okay, great. Well, I think that's a nice balance, and it does start working through those more expensive projects, but where there's low-hanging fruit, kind of pick those. I'm interested in how you get the speed score. There's the 85th percentile speed, and I look particularly at the data for the Stewart project. Apparently, the 85th percentile speed is nearly 40 miles an hour. That's kind of shocking. I don't see that on Stewart Road, but apparently that's
I think Stewart bounced up because of the accidents. There were more accidents that in the ranking.
Yeah, I noticed it has a collision score of 10 as
yeah.
well. So how do you, both of those, how do you get from the 85th percentile speed to the speed score? Because there are some projects that also have a high 85th percentile speed and actually go much higher as a speed score. And then secondly, how do you get the collision score?
I think the collisions are just actual reported collisions. I don't know if it's entering site distance issues. I don't have specifics about why
okay.
the collisions bounced.
Maybe this is something to come back with then. But Stewart Road has a collision score of 10. And Rollins, and that's the section of Rollins kind of near Maplewood, where the bridge over County House Branch, it's been an accident or a crash hotspot for many years. Somebody was killed there pretty recently. That only has a collision score of 2.67, so I'm just curious about that difference.
Well, they what the engineers have told me, that's a three-year rolling collision history. So you may have 1 year might have a high number, then when we roll ahead, that drops off.
Mm-hmm.
If it's been
more
safer, then you're going
to
get a newer or changed number.
Well,
that.
I just love to see the formula that came up with those two numbers
okay.
when we look at that
we
again.
We can bring that back.
As well as the formula that converts the 85th percentile speed into a speed score.
Lee tried to explain that to me, and it was a little technical for me, and I'll bring something forward that explains that a little clearer.
Okay, good. So you've reviewed projects that citizens have come forward with a petition and asked you to look at. And for some of those, you've done a reevaluation, and that's resulted in Rollins Road moving up from
27th to 4th.
To 4th, and Stewart Road moving up from something to 1st. Do you have a system to routinely reevaluate? I imagine that things are really changing all the time.
I do know they were sending counters out,
mm-hmm.
trying to hit it at the time where not so much in the summer. You know, when we have when the students are in. So, you know, we have a window there where we're not putting counters out. I think we currently own maybe 4 counters. And so it's really about resources at this point on staffing. Lee's pretty much the person that
right.
runs this program. And if we can get a consultant, then what we'd ask them to do is to bring forward counters, you know, and really ramp up the
do a lot of the field
yes.
work.
And that field work and the engineering will bring some recommendations quicker.
Okay. Then my final question, the projects, the level 2 and level 3 projects that you did in 2015, Prairie Lane, Derby Ridge, College Park, and Manor, do they continue to get evaluated after you've intervened?
We did a follow-up, and I'm thinking the report indicated that those speed limits dropped 6 to 8 miles per hour.
The actual speeds
measured. Mm-hmm. So those good. Were what we would deem as effective.
I think it would be nice to see those on the league table as well, with a notation that they have been, you know, level two or level three has been applied, and this is where they are now across all those criteria. Because if those speeds and crashes have dropped, then that's evidence that the program's really working.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Just one more comment. Your comments made me think about it. I mean, I was very appreciative to see Kelsey Drive in here because for political reasons, obviously, but also because it's a thoroughfare for speed and so on. But there's also another component to this, and Kelsey Drive and this expansion of Rice Road to include Kelsey, because it is kind of a cut-through area all the way from Ballinger and through Kelsey and then out to Lake of the Woods Road and down to that infamous Demerit Drive area. So there's a public safety aspect. In addition to speed and traffic and so on, it's also a corridor for frankly, some of the more undesirable folks to be using this as a cut-through. Is there any possibility of factoring in that kind of thing along with safety concerns beyond just the traffic for traffic calming, but also using that as a basis to factor in some of these problem areas with public safety in terms of crime? I don't know. It's just a suggestion.
One example to your point is many cities, and we've done this here occasionally, you'll have a street that's particularly problematic, and so you might put bollards in it and just close the street through traffic. It's a very effective tool for certain applications. You wouldn't want to do that here, but that's an example of what you're talking about. We can take a look at that and come back with other thoughts.
You know, you could do a destination study where you almost read license plates to know whether people lived on the street or were using as a cut through. Very, very intensive, and you'd have to take the plate down. You have to find out where they lived,
I'm just trying to brainstorm here not only in terms of traffic safety, but safety in general, and if you can somehow factor that in, it might be a consideration anyway. That's all.
I got a couple of comments. Just as we bring it forward, I'll be brief. I like the idea of expanding the Rice Road project to involve Kelsey Drive. I also think the expanding the scope of the Sexton Road project to take in account the local planning process is really smart. I don't know what it would push off, and that would be worth the real crux of the discussion, but Rollins Road scored really high and there was a death, you know. I think that's significant to me. And then just kind of one project that staff asked me about on Bodie Drive, there is some existing traffic calming that are like kind of mini roundabouts that are ineffective because people take them the opposite way. I was asked if there was a neighborhood champion for that because I'd done a lot of canvassing and done some neighborhood picnics and talked to a lot of people who are very supportive of a traffic calming. I didn't do a lot of like just to kind of cut down on people being concerned about what am I doing there and writing stuff down. I didn't take a lot of notes or track down those addresses, but I think that would be a great project for Glenn Cobbins and Judy Hubbard to identify a local champion on that street. I'd hate to add anything to the list, but again, because of the impetus of the strategic plan, I think Mr. Scala's comments in regards to public safety components of some of these, if people are using these roads to do shots fired incidents and then flee out very quickly, you know, some speed humps, you know, really then become a bigger priority, because that's also like the traffic is life and death too. And I get that, but I think those are factors to consider, you know. So that would be, just make that request while we're talking about traffic calming.
Any other comments? Okay. The next report is...
Confirm, you want them to come back so that the public can come?
Yes.
So bring them
yeah,
back
let's have a public hearing item, a resolution or whatever. And, okay. Then we can make sure that people who live close to all of the potential projects have the opportunity to come and speak.
Oh, I will warn council members that all of the roads adjoining where you're looking for council members, once they're not going to follow this at all, and when they start to do the construction, you're going to get a ton of complaints. So just to let you know what fun you can expect. But very pleased with the Derby Ridge experience, in spite of the withering attacks I took for that.
Report 1416 is a report, information report on the administrative public improvement process, which is detailed on page 3 of the report. It gives a criteria for projects that don't have to have public hearings, basically. And this is one that's under the $50,000 limit. It's $10,000. It's a connector on County House Road, which goes underneath Chapel Hill, and you really need a connection to Chapel Hill. And so basically, unless there is an objection from the council, staff plans to move forward with this under the administrative public improvement process.
And is the purpose, because that's more efficient to go, just to save
faster
a bit of time? Yeah, I did have an objection to it, actually. Somebody emailed me today and said they thought it was a waste of public money. So I'm not quite sure whether I should object to just, I support it. I think it's...
It would be a slower waste of money, I guess, if we use the other process. But,
unless you changed your mind, unless we all changed our minds.
True, yeah, you could potentially...
But well, if you can't even change your own, Mr. Thomas, I don't know if you're going to persuade anyone else.
I don't live in that part of town, but I've ridden County House Trail, and I think you really need access.
It allows you to come straight off the trail and get on.
Yeah,
the
absolutely,
sidewalk,
right? Absolutely.
And it connects that development.
I think it's
so
a great idea.
You go ahead.
Okay. So, without objection, that was easy. Report 1516 is about downtown noise enforcement. This is sort of a deja vu for me because I think this was one of the issues that I was confronted with when I started, 6 years ago. Now it's kind of boomeranging back in the form of this report. So I'll let – it's an informational report. Staff, any comments?
We see – more of this probably coming in the future as more folks live downtown. There are entertainment venues downtown, and so some of which are devoted to live music. So it's we expect there will be more of this as we move forward. We try to navigate the middle the best we can. We have an ordinance. We enforce it where we can and on a complaint basis. And so when someone is really getting too far out of their lane, we kind of bring them back in. And I think that's what this sort of represents, and it's where we are.
Is that this noise ordinance? It goes beyond the downtown area. I can remember a couple times asking because there were complaints about Whiskey Wild Saloon, on the weekends, right? And something. I mean, this really persists beyond just the downtown area, and this was driven by the there was a wall there for a while that they were putting up a wall. Remember that?
I do. Yes, they put up a sheet rock
across the road from
plywood.
Where the Katy Station used to be over there, and then they resolved that whole issue and so on. But yeah, this noise ordinance thing is always kind of touchy, but some of it is pretty. I mean, the violations of it are pretty outrageous sometimes.
What I see as having happened here is there were numerous complaints, and one particular resident of the Niedermeyer, whose room is right across the road from Harpo's, had mentioned to me multiple times. And so I asked for a clarification on what exactly the rules are. Is it excessively loud, a distance of 150 feet between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. and all that? So that's really helpful to see what the rules are. But what I noticed happened is that shortly after I made the request for that clarification and referenced Harpo's in particular, another complaint was received and the police responded, and this time they issued a summons. Was that because I had raised it to that level, or was this a more egregious violation?
It was the number of complaints.
It kind of built up.
Yeah, and your comment, of course, is another...
another layer.
So,
and what's the consequence for Harpo's of this? They were summoned. Have they paid a fine or what?
I'm not sure about the fine. It's generally we have a good sit down and we explain what you need to do to be a good neighbor and what path not being a good neighbor head you in.
So what the next step would be if they don't?
Yes.
Okay, because I have heard from the same resident of the Niedermeyer that at around about that time things dramatically improved, and he made the took the trouble to tell me that probably in about November.
It's good to hear. You know, most folks want to be good neighbors.
Sure.
And they just, this is kind of a carrot and stick approach, right?
I mean, we try the carrot first. Yeah. Right. Well, we show them the stick.
Well, thank you. That's good.
I have a comment on this as well. The Downtown Community Improvement District partnered with the Responsible Hospitality Institute for a comprehensive review of an interesting reading. I didn't read the entire report, but some sections of particular interest to me. And there's an Ann Arbor law that requires when you get a permit that you have a cell phone listed so that if you get a noise complaint, the police can simply send a text saying, turn it down. So it seems like it would be a way to reduce our police resources on kind of doing that. And I think that's worth looking at. So if you didn't get a copy of that, I could forward you their report. It looks like a common sense small step we could take to further improve the situation.
We'll follow up on that.
Report 16-16 is informational. It's a report on interdepartmental transfer of funds. Are there any questions?
I had one question about that. I noticed that some of the consulting fees for Jim Wick, Carl Kenny, Glenn Carbins, and Judy Hubbard were referenced in there as being transferred from one account to another. I can't remember exactly which. Where did that money for those contracts come from?
That's all from savings from 2014.
Okay.
Yeah, and so those were programmed in the last budget.
For the strategic plan implementation?
Strategic plan implementation.
Okay.
But we didn't put them in a specific account until we got these contracts. So we're just moving them into the account they needed to be in to pay those contracts.
Thank you.
But that's the purpose.
I will invite anyone from the public to speak for 3 minutes about anything.
My name is Richard Hayes. Live at 1411 West Rollins. Lived at that address for 26 years. So we've been able to see a definite increase in the amount of traffic, the speed of traffic coming down West Rollins Road, particularly from in the blocks between West Boulevard and Maplewood. Because other people in the neighborhood are also concerned about the amount of traffic. It seems to be part of the issue because West Rollins Road is the main conduit between Stadium in the south and Broadway in the north. People wanted to go from West Boulevard to Stadium as it heads south. So we initiated a petition in November. It was signed by almost 40 people. Everyone, with the exception of two people that I contacted, signed the petition. All had voiced a lot of concern about the volume of traffic and the speed of traffic, and not only automobiles, but also bicyclists, skateboarders. If you've ever been down where the little bridge is, it's like a ski jump down there. So they get quite a head of steam up going down there, and there's been numerous accidents. Pets have been run over. A year and a half ago, a person in a pickup ran into the south wall of the bridge, caving in the west side of it. We're looking to get that work done here, hopefully within the next few months. We submitted the petition to the Department of Public Works. submitted a copy to our councilman, Ian Thomas, who has been very, very helpful to us in kind of guiding us through this process. So we're very eager we're very pleased that we got given a higher rating on the priority list due to the recount they did on the traffic volume. So we're hoping, if possible, we could get it taken care of this year. We'd like to see that there's some traffic calming measures taken in that stretch of road, whether it be speed humps, whether it be reducing the speed to 25 miles an hour all the way down. Any of that would be helpful. What Councilman Nasr talked about could be helpful as well. So we're all for it, and hopefully that they'll be able to kind of be able to get this taken care of as soon as possible. We don't want any more fatalities.
Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Jacob McFarlane. I'm Dick's neighbor, actually. I live at the corner of Westridge and Rollins. I don't have the period of time that Dick has in the neighborhood. My wife, Tiffany, and I moved in about a year and a half ago, and we live there with our daughter, Virginia, who is 10 months old, added her since we got there. So I've been paying a lot of attention to the traffic on Rollins, and I was really kind of disappointed when I moved in with the velocity of the traffic on the road. But it's not so much the average, so when we look at the study, I hope we'll take a look at if they're able to do a speed study, what the outliers are, because it's really not necessarily the average. It's the couple of really high velocity cars that come down during the night that are really scary. I'd also like to point out that in the area, I haven't known the area for very long, but they're can't seem to throw a rock without hitting a house with a young child in it right now. And as a new parent, that's become a big concern of mine. And I think that's what's driving a lot of the concerns of the other neighbors that are getting active in this process. So that, in addition to the fact that we do have, as Dick said, a lot of bicyclists and other kids using the road for skateboarding or for sledding. Sunday there were a bunch of kids sledding down Westridge, with a problem at the end there as they come to Rollins. Traffic was behaving well and the kids were behaving well. But the area is really going to be chock full of children and people wanting to do fun things and be able to commute safely on that road. As a bicyclist commuter myself, I also have a big problem coming down that road with oncoming traffic at the bridge where it narrows, not yielding, which is not a big problem, but coming at me at, 40, 45 miles an hour is pretty scary. So I'd be strongly in support of speed humps or something that will actually force drivers to think about slowing down. I don't think that putting up any number of signs is going to change it. With the giant hills on either side, people just have the natural habit of taking their foot off the brake and going down the hill. So I hope that we'll be able to get some speed humps in or something that can actually get in the way of traffic and force a behavioral change in drivers. Thanks.
Thank you.
John Clark, 403 North 9th Street. I wouldn't be here except some people interviewed me, and then I had a wonderful conversation with Ginger Owens about a book called A Pattern Language. Anybody know about it? He does. Seriously? You all really need to know this. She and her group are working on these concepts about, it's city and urban planning together. But the reason I came back, since nobody asked me, I disagree with Nancy's characterization of the condition that I proposed. This didn't occur to me until I got here. If I'd worked on it beforehand and had thought about it, then I'd been in a position to have it there, and so I kind of understand. But the fact is, I don't see that much difference between that and the 15% impervious surface condition on the Parkside plat. I didn't have the language down yet, but it can be easily definable and measurable. And if I can get some people who are much more versed in land use regulation law to work with me, the next time we come, you won't be able to shut us off. because I see this as a significant tool under our current subdivision regulations, and I would hope that these kind of things are not outlawed under, and because I don't, I hope we don't adopt anything about our code thing stuff, at least for a year, because it's just not ready. But under those kind of rules, these things I think can be quite useful. And as I say, if I'd had time before you voted and had thought about all this, I think I could have convinced you that we could meet the test of definability and measurability. We'll come back with that because the same people I'm going to talk to, I hope we're going to propose an ordinance to you that defines how the city staff will evaluate sufficiency of resources in this intersection between sanitary sewer and stormwater sewer in such a way that you, it's not just, oh, well, they're saying they're set. It will be an enforceable thing. And therefore, until problems like this are solved, basically, you can issue a building permit, but you won't be allowed, and that will be the council will have to set down those rules that prevent the staff from doing that. And one of the reasons for doing that is we have dawdled way too long on fixing our infill and infrastructure stuff, largely in many ways because we don't have sufficient staff and they're working on this relief sewer. So we're 2 years further behind than we need be on that. This kind of thing will put appropriate pressure on them to allocate their time resources better or to ask you for more resources to do it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Any questions? I always should ask that. I'm not insulted that you don't have them, but I get some smiles.
Anyone else? We'll go to council comments. Should we start down this way? Any comments?
Sure.
All right.
I have a list. We had, council had requested a report on Creasy Springs, if there's something we can do about the curve there. I remember this from like May of last year.
Somebody was killed there.
Yeah, recently. Someone was killed there, and that reminded me when you brought up Rollin Road. So do we have a report on that, or is there one coming at some point? I don't remember ever seeing one. So
it's, yeah, it's been worked on, but it hasn't come back to you yet.
Okay. All right. And then could I request a report on Rolling Hills and WW out there near Old Hawthorne? There's, you know, we're having increasing traffic out there, and now we're going to be putting in a school down there. And apparently the developer's supposed to put in either a roundabout or a traffic light. And I'm not sure which he's decided to do, and I don't know what the time frame is for that. So if we could get a report on that, and I don't know if there's a recommendation for it being a roundabout or a traffic light. What do our traffic engineers think? I think it's a county road and a city road. So if we could get a report on what's happening and what the recommendations are from the experts, that'd be helpful. And there was one other thing, which I can't remember, and I didn't write down, so I'll ask you next time.
I'd like to follow up on the high-voltage transmission lines. I sent a kind of a my understanding of the different parameters that we're really trying, the problems we're trying to solve and the parameters. And there was a list of questions at the end of that document, the first of which was, are my assumptions correct? You'd mentioned at that particular council meeting that you would schedule a work session to really dig into. Mm-hmm. Do you have a tentative date for that?
I think it's sometime after April.
Okay.
Yeah. Probably second meeting in April or
you first don't think it's more urgent May. To move forward more quickly than that?
Not for no. No. It's one of those things, it's a critically important project, but we have some time to
okay.
work on it.
And then the other thing, I want to just make the observation that there's quite a large group of young people at the back of the room, including my good friend Gabriel Gassman. I guess this is a group of MU students. I'm not sure whether they're here for a class project or just out of sheer personal interest in attending the council meeting, but it's great to see for certain.
What a better way to spend
it. Let me think.
I'm guessing there's credit involved. I don't know.
Did you hire them to come here?
No. It was... Betsy pointed it out first, actually.
I've got a little list, but it's a very short list. This reminds me of Gilbert and Sullivan, right? And that's it, too. But I just have one thing on my list, and it deals with it, it's kind of related in a way. This is the land clearance thing for the sewer. It has to do with the 45-foot width on the MKT trail that was pretty shocking to everyone. And I've been talking a little bit about it to the press as well, even though it's not really in my ward, and that gets to the other connection because the headwaters of the Hinkson Creek and those sewer crossings bear on this whole issue. I can remember when we had that discussion with the six crossings of Hinkson Creek as to whether or not they ought to be trenched or bored at that time. We didn't talk quite as much about boring at that time. But Mr. Glasscock had offered some advice in response to some questions that came up about, geez, why the big path? Why is it necessary to clear that much path for a sewer line like that? And the answer to that at that time had a lot to do with the safety of people in the trench, so this thing, in fact, would not cave in on them and to be able to deal with this whole thing. 45 feet seems like a lot, but we're talking about a big sewer trunk, and frankly, if you did 30 feet and you needed 35 or 40 feet, the roots would be compacted anyway. Some of these trees would have to go. Once again, I'm going to say it. I've said it a number of times. Growth has lots of benefits. It also has some costs, and this is one of those costs. What I will suggest, however, and I'd like to see a report on this as to the justification for these the amount of space and what the remediation is going to be in terms of replacing it and the some of the benefits, because we might be able to get a trail out of it, all that kind of thing. All that's fair game. But I really do think that we need to inoculate the public before we do so. We always have this problem. We can't seem to get the word out early enough, and then when we do get the word out, somebody says, "Well, I never heard about that." I mean, there is always that problem, but we have to really, I think, take an extra measure to make sure that before we start sawing down these trees, whatever the need, and this is one of those costs that we have. We have to make sure that people understand what it is that we're going to do and how we're going to try and undo it once we get it done. I'd just like a report on how we deal with the notification process, how we deal with the clearance idea, what is absolutely necessary, and what we can do for the remediation for these kinds of things, both in terms of this MKT trail and in terms of the Hinkson Creek and the sewer crossings.
I have one thing. I want to talk about pawn shop reform. A long time ago, I asked for a report or an ordinance in regards to, a lot of the drug trade drives it. We had record high burglaries last year. You can steal somebody's golf clubs and go to a sporting goods place and walk out with cash without ever showing an ID or having any ability to track it. The police, from my understanding, have drafted an ordinance. It's been in front of legal. I've been patient, as I know that legal has been stretched by everybody that's suing us. Been winning some. But I think it's beyond that time for review, and I think that it's moved into the realm of it's time for a political decision. So I think I would like to see that brought forward. I have seen too many troubling overdose deaths, and so I'm going to push staff to do what we can administratively and on a policy-wide to support police and see what we can do to undercut drug trade. I'm tired of the carnage. I'm tired of seeing people that I care about die, and I have vowed to bring this up in every council comment until it comes forward with increasing vehemence until it's brought forward and we can give it a fair hearing, take in stakeholder input, and give it an up or down vote. So that's my
dispassionate plea to bring this forward promptly.
I have one comment. I've spoken about this before. I've spoken with the city manager. I've also brought it up during one of the previous council meetings about a particular area that's a concern to me on Worley Street across from Smithton Middle School. The traffic in the morning and the evening with the drop-off and pickup is terrible. It's a lot of cars moving very fast, and there is no crosswalk for children to get across the street and to the school from the north side of Worley. I have a particular interest in this because I live on the north side of Worley in that area. And so for 20 years, I've seen my children, now my grandchildren, risk their lives trying to get across the street to get to Smithton Middle School. So if there's anything that can be done, a crosswalk or something to slow the traffic down so that those children will not have to run to get to school across the traffic that's not obligated to stop for any reason, that would be very helpful. And I'm sure that there's something that can be done that will not be expensive, maybe just a painted crosswalk or something.
You know, one thing you could do, Clyde, is get a petition of, 30 residents and just get right into the traffic calming program, and it would get evaluated, the quick evaluation immediately.
Okay.
No, another option for that too, and one of them that's been very successful, and that was the one on Clark Lane when we actually have some of the flashing lights pedestrian activated flashing lights that at least provide some additional protection for those folks that have to get across high speed traffic ways.
Meeting's adjourned.